Monday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Our sponsors today, SeatGeek. You can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via the code CAPSPACE. And Zeal, Z-E-E-L. Go to zeal.com, enter promo code CAPSPACE at checkout, and get $25 off your first in-home on-demand massage. So here's what's on tap for today. Got to go through a lot of news, especially this latest Lakers Palace intrigue with Jim and Johnny Buss attempting rather ham-fistedly to wrest control from Genie. And then also we got to get to some games, Golden State and Atlanta, Houston and San Antonio. That was an awesome game tonight. And Boston and the Clippers as well. Where shall we start when it comes to news, Danny?
Palace intrigue, as usual. I think that the story here is really just kind of a ham-fisted last-ditch effort to try to wrest control that fundamentally was about a specific piece of terminology.
Yeah, so essentially, the Lakers are now held in a trust. The Buss family owns 66% of it and are supposed to control three seats on the board. Both the trust and the condition of the NBA ownership states that the controlling owner, that's Jeannie Buss, that's the person who makes the final decision with the NBA, she must be on the board. And of course, it always has been. She's always been voted onto the board and voted as controlling owner every year as the trust demands. The trust has language that says that the other Buss children must make what measures are reasonably available to them to fix it so that Genie is the controlling owner. That's what Jerry Buss wanted. He also left Jim in control of basketball operations, but gave Genie the ability to make those changes if she wanted to. Of course, about a week ago, that's precisely what happened. Just before the trade deadline, Magic Johnson coming in, Jim is out. Johnny, who's never really been involved with the team at all, Mark Heisler had a rather unflattering summary of what he's done with his life for the LA Times, a veteran LA writer. And so what the two older brothers decided to do was just basically see if they could sneak one past Genie. And the way they did that was they called a board meeting. Of course, to call a board meeting, you have to send notice to everyone, to the owners and the rest of the board. They claimed that this board meeting was overdue. And at said board meeting, they nominated four people to take on the three slots that the Buss family is allowed to control out of the five on the board. And none of them were Genie Buss. And so Genie Buss was locked in. Her attorneys presumably were locked in. They noticed this fact. They sent a bunch of letters to Jim and Johnny, did not get an adequate response. And so then they actually had to go into court and file a request for an injunction to remove this board meeting at which Genie was not nominated as one of the potential board members. By basically all of the accounts, and I haven't been able to get my hands on the actual filings yet, so when I do, if there's anything interesting that comes out of that, I'll let you know. But Genie's response did at least say that essentially there could be irreparable harm because Jim has run the franchise into the ground and they have to get him out of there as soon as possible, as she did. That was one of the amusing pieces of the filing that came out. And as a result of that, they withdrew their attempts to have this board meeting and issued very, very unconvincing denials about this that said basically, oh yeah, we always respect her right to be the controlling owner. We voted her that a bunch of times. Oh, well then why wasn't she listed on the proposed directors? No comment, essentially, from the brother's attorney. So now there's a trial set for later this spring in which this will get fleshed out. The brothers are claiming, oh, she ran to court for no reason. That certainly appears to be false. And we'll see what happens. But this was just some sort of weird coup attempt, last ditch effort. And they just didn't have the horses to pull it off. And as soon as they got caught, apparently just went running back with their tails between their legs.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a part of this story now is that that they just couldn't really piece it together. And hopefully this kind of clarifies the situation, at least for the time being, and we can move on to the other Lakers drama of them trying to keep their pick.
Yeah, the really important part. Before we move on here, we got lots more news to get to here as well. It's been a busy couple of days. First, this from Zeal. Zeal is in-home massage. It's a lot more convenient than going to a bricks and mortar place because obviously they come to you. And it's 20 to 50% less expensive than going to a local spa or hotel. What's more, when you get your massage on demand with Zeal, with as little as an hour's lead time beforehand, by the way, if you just need that massage immediately, you're really feeling stressed out, more of the money goes to the actual masseuse, which of course can make you feel better about things. Wouldn't you rather that the compensation meant to the person is actually putting their hands on you and relieving all of your tension as opposed to just the spa owner? This is really, in a way, pretty similar to a lot of the products we advertise, in which you're taking out the middleman, which is the spa owner. You don't have to pay for them to rent out a space. You can just do it in your home. You can get it on demand when you want. It's just a better way to get a massage. And they have over 8,000 licensed therapists. When my therapist came over, I talked to her about what the process was. It was a quite thorough vetting. And of course, to help you get started, we'll give you a discount via the promo code CAPSPACE, which is easy to remember, of course, since we talk about it all the time on the program. You can get $25 off your first massage at ZEEL.com. Make sure you click on add a promo code at checkout to use my code CAPSPACE. Let them know that you came from us, of course, as well. So that's ZEEL.com. CAPSPACE code gets you $25 off your first in-home on-demand massage. All right, now let's move on to maybe the shortest buyout career, post-buyout career of anyone that we've ever seen. Unfortunate, although in some ways also a little bit ironic.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have two different kinds of short-lived buyouts here, but the Andrew Bogut news is very disappointing. I think it was about 50 seconds into his first appearance on the Cleveland Cavaliers.
No, 58 seconds.
Yeah. He was going out, it was to contest a three, and then kind of as the player was dribbling by him, kind of put his leg out.
It was Okaro White.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought, to me, it looked like Bogut put his leg out a little bit to try to deter the drive, not exactly an uncommon thing, and got hit exactly wrong. And we already know he broke his left tibia.
Yeah. Apparently, LeBron James said after the game that he heard it crack. Bogut did as well. He knew that it had happened. And, you know, I always felt like the impact that Bogut might had was a little bit overrated, but part of the reason for that was because we worried that he wouldn't be able to stay healthy. I think we said before, you know, what are the chances that he and Deron Williams are both going to be healthy by the final? You said 50%. And it turns out that that's the case. And I feel poorly for Bogut. You know, he just has had such a star-crossed career in terms of injuries, was never the same after that elbow, but when he got pushed in the back by Amari Stoudemire in 2010, used to be a very skilled player, good shooter, good post player, just was never the same after that. And then had those ankle troubles really for over a year. And then, of course, that hyperextended knee last year in the finals, that it looked like it was actually a lot worse. That happened about like 10 rows in front of me when it happened, and you thought that it was going to be a massive injury. So it just, and also really bad for him because this was his chance to maybe get one last decent contract. And it appears like now that with this having been a lost year for him, that's not going to happen. We haven't gotten an official diagnosis yet, but I mean, like, this looked like a serious broken leg. Like, I think the type of thing where, you know, 2 months at the absolute minimum before you're going to be able to come back, and then that's really even when you're starting to weight bear, then you got to build up all the muscle around it again too. It's really too bad for him, too bad for the Cavs, and you know, now they still really need another center, especially with Kevin Love out. We'll see what happens there. Anything else you want to add on that one?
No, I think that's about it. Feel bad for him. It was a nice opportunity, a nice fit between somebody who could be a capable vet, sop up some minutes for them and going through it. But I think you want to move on to the other injured former Warrior center.
Yeah, Festus Ezeli, we knew this was coming for a long time. It was a little bit odd. He did not join the team on a road trip like about a month and a half ago. And there was some thought, he was like saying goodbye to people. There's some thought that, oh, it must be because he's having surgery. And then his agent denied that he was having surgery. I don't know why they did that, because eventually this cadaver, I think meniscus, became available. And I think it's called an allograft when you have a cadaver part put in you. And it was difficult for him to find a donor, of course, given his size. And so that's what he's going to try to do, I guess, to like get some more cushioning in that knee so it doesn't keep swelling up. It's going to be a very extensive surgery. You have to imagine he's guaranteed for $1 million next year. There's no way that that option or that guarantee is going to get exercised by Portland. Maybe he'll get some kind of a minimum make good. And also consider now, I mean, I think he's 27 already now, closing in on 28. So I think it's very possible now, we talked about this at the time, but that maybe the last moment that he plays in the NBA was that fourth quarter of game seven when he gave up a three and then fouled LeBron on a three-shot foul, which it's really too bad. That's got to be pretty rough when the last moment of your career was something like that, and then you're just never able to get healthy again.
It's been a tough go of it for him for a long time. I mean, every time it felt like he was getting into a little bit of a rhythm, something would come and sidetrack him. That's just the story of Festus's 4 years on the Warriors, and it's even been exacerbated greatly. And it ties in with the idea we had talked about it back when we did the mock rookie extensions and mock off season and numerous other things about calibrating his value and how it was all dependent on what teams thought of his knees. And we knew when Portland signed him to a $7 million contract with a partial guarantee on the second year that it didn't look good, and it doesn't look good.
We'll see. Maybe this procedural work, he is the first NBA player that I can recall has ever had
something like this done. Carson Palmer had it in the NFL.
Well, you know what? I saw that in Haynes's piece. It's not really quite the same, I don't think, because I don't think that was the same procedure. Like Palmer tore his ACL, and there was a time when the standard of care for doing your ACL was actually to get a cadaver ACL ligament. And now what they do instead is they take part of your patellar tendon from, it used to be actually you would take it from the same knee, and now actually they changed it to where they'll even take it from the other knee so that you're not also causing yourself patellar tendonitis in that same knee in addition to the torn ACL. So I don't think it's quite the same. I mean, he did use cadaver parts, but this to me, and I haven't gotten a great sense of what it is in terms of what the surgery is going to be, but it sounds like, because all of his issues are like, you know, not having enough cartilage, getting swelling, like it's not a ligament issue that he has at this point. So I think that that's what they're going to do. And I mean, I remember when I went to get my surgery on my torn patellar tendon and ACL at Dr. James Andrews, I talked to a guy who actually had, I think, a cadaver meniscus put in. He was like a wakeboarder or something, and I had never heard of the procedure at that time, and I think it's going to be somewhat similar. I'm not sure who's doing the surgery, but anyway, I'm probably going too far into the realm of speculation here to know exactly what it's going to be, but it'll be interesting. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who will be interested to see what happens here, because lack of cartilage is so big of a problem for a lot of guys. We certainly wish him the best of luck.
Last piece of news, as far as I can tell, unless, did we ever talk about Terrence Jones? Because otherwise we could do with a little
I don't think. Yeah, I mean, we should go through some of these transactions. Terrence Jones was released by the Pelicans ostensibly as a favor to his agent. We'll see if there's some more to that or not. And then he actually was signed by the Bucks. I don't really get why.
Because they can collect all the offense first, shaky ground power forwards. I mean, they might as well at this point.
I mean, yeah, like so now he can sit behind Michael Beasley just like he did last year.
Because Beasley's injury wasn't that severe, right?
Yeah.
Like it was like a week or two or something like that.
Yeah. Who did they release to pick up Terrence Jones? Or were they just at 14?
I think that was the roster spot they cleared in the Hibbert deal.
Ah, yes. Yes, they cut top 55 protected second round pick to that they got back in the Hibbert deal to pick up Jones. So I mean, the Bucks still on the fringes of the playoff race. I don't see Jones helping them a ton. They've really been in some odd straits lately, but have been winning. They beat Philly today in a blowout, pretty much straight through. So they're still there a little bit. Chris Middleton is starting to play a lot better. They're still starting Thon Maker. I don't know how much longer that's going to last, although I've liked what I've seen from him in spurts. They've been starting like every game like negative 10 when he's in there, and he's been getting the Keith Bogans lately. But yeah, I just don't really see where Terrence Jones is going to come in and help them. They don't need another combo forward who, or I guess really more of a combo big, who doesn't really protect the rim or play much defense and just can score a little bit. It doesn't really make much sense in terms of a fit. They got plenty of fours on that team that are better than him.
Also, Cleveland cut Jordan McRae to sign Andrew Bogut. you know, we'll see what they do now. And then Daniel House got waived by the Wizards so that they could clear the spot for Brandon Jennings. And though we didn't get to see what would have been one of the stranger quote-unquote revenge games in NBA history, the Atlanta Hawks actually claimed Jose Calderon off waivers instead of just letting him clear waivers and put him on the roster.
Yeah, because by claiming him, I think they actually saved a little bit of money there, and also made sure that nobody else claimed him, I guess, who was behind them in the waiver order. But yeah, he did not play tonight against the Warriors. In New Orleans, recall all of the transactions that they've had to make. They signed Hollis Thompson now to a second 10-day contract. Jarrett Jack, whom they signed and actually looked semi-decent, immediately tore his right meniscus and had to be released. They signed Jordan Crawford out of the Chinese League instead, and he had 19 points on 8 of 15 from the field today in 20 minutes against Utah. Might have actually been their best offensive hope against Utah, as they lost that game. The only game they've won so far with Cousins in the lineup has been at the Lakers. So, and remember when, like, the Pels released Caspi and signed Reggie Williams? I mean, has Reggie Williams played like a minute for them yet? He's played like 5 minutes or something. Like,
yeah, a very short stretch of time. And Caspi, I'm frustrated for them because he would have been a good fit and had the small bird rights, but I'm also frustrated by all the other teams that could have made a decent move for him.
Yeah, we've probably spent too much time carping that the rest of the league doesn't appreciate Omri Caspi the way we do. Dirk Nowitzki on a podcast with Mark Stein, which was a good listen. I recommend that one on the True Hoop feed. Said basically that he's planning on playing next year. He had made noises about potentially retiring as he struggled those first couple months of the year with the Achilles injury. Now, though, feeling better, has been playing effectively. Maybe he'll go to playing off the bench next year, but it has been starting. I think if there's a big man that fits reasonably well with him, it's Nerlens Noel. Dallas has actually been rolling pretty decently here. The intrigue with Dirk will come from the fact that he has this team option that's $25 million next year. Is he going to expect that they're going to pick that up? Is he going to, again, maybe take the discount and they can get into the market? Maybe this Dallas team, I mean, they're not going to be a championship contender, but maybe if they could sign one big free agent who could be a starter, or maybe they could even get enough money to get into the free agent point guard mix in addition to whomever they end up drafting and what that draft pick is. All that's going to be very interesting. And I mean, they'll almost certainly will decline his team option because they have to do that before the new league year. And they can always just re-sign him to that contract later again if they want to, or they can be flexible. But I see really few ways in which that team option actually just gets picked up. But Dirk says he definitely wants to finish out that contract.
Small piece of CBA nerdery that ended up being important in this. So Dallas, originally it sounded like the deal they were going to do with Dirk was that they were going to give him $20 million this season and then give him a partial guarantee of $5 million for next season. Instead, what they've done is they paid him $25 this year and then made it a team option. That gives them substantially more flexibility because now they don't have to treat any salary for next year as kind of like a given. They can be a lot more flexible with it depending on what he wants. And yeah, it's possible that he doesn't use that flexibility, but paying him that extra $5 million now is really going to return dividends.
Yeah, and they had the ability to do that with his cap hold. I mean, I remember we were actually critical of them for not doing that when the news initially came out, and then it became clear that they, of course, had, in fact, given him the team option. All right, I think that's about it for news here. Why don't we start with what I thought was the game of the day, Houston and San Antonio. Great duel between two of the leading MVP candidates, Kawhi Leonard and James Harden. And Kawhi had, really to end the game, one of probably the best 20-second sequences that you're ever going to see down the end of a game.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was an illustration of his prior value and then his present value, because he drilled a really tough three over Nene that gave them the lead, and then comes back down, doesn't, you know, sit high because he got that big shot, knew there was a big defensive possession left, got into position, held firm, blocked James Harden, and then stayed involved in the play. I think Aldridge got credit for the second block on that play, but he stayed involved.
Yeah.
And then got the rebound and then nailed the two free throws to ice it.
Yeah, Kawhi came off a screen, and Nene, who's a pretty good switch guy on him, just pulled up right in his face. They were only down one, so the three, I think, was a little bit surprising, but and I think they were going for the two for one. There are about 39 seconds left. And after making that, Houston went with a great no timeout. Harden just pushed it down their throats. It was great. It was a great play. He was going to make a layup, and Kawhi actually was behind him, came up and just had a great block with the left, just inches before it was going to hit the glass for what would have been a goaltend. I know it wasn't quite as good as LeBron's block against Andre Iguodala last year, because LeBron came out of nowhere even more than Kawhi did. But, you know, it was the next best thing to that. Really an incredible play. And then after Kawhi hits two free throws to put them up four, the Rockets go for, it looked like a three. Eric Gordon came off a screen. The play was for a three. They double team Gordon. Nene goes right to the rim. There's the kind of quick two that aren't going to be as critical of, because they just threw it right to a guy wide open under the hoop for a dunk, you know, and they tried for the three first. It wasn't there. They took that away. So with time wasting, you need to at least get some points. So I wasn't critical of that. And then I also liked the fact that initially they went for the trap, tried to get an 8 second violation, and that the ball, I think, was inbounded with about 14 seconds left. And unfortunately, they were not able to get that 8 second violation. And they probably should have fouled well before that, because by the time Kawhi threw it into the front court, they really didn't even try to foul until there was like 1 second left. They did commit a foul with like 1.5 seconds left, and D'Antoni was riled up that they didn't get that foul call. But with 1.5 seconds left, they were already burned anyway. So they had to foul a little bit earlier. I liked the idea behind it, just the execution was not very good.
No real arguments for me on any of that. I do want to bring attention to, while Kawhi ended the game with a great flourish, James Harden was absolutely spectacular in the first quarter of this game. He was just dominant. The Spurs couldn't do anything to stop him. 18 points, 6 of 7 from the field. And so you think, wow, great scoring. He also had 6 assists and no turnovers. Just he was getting wherever he wanted, was creating quality looks for his teammates. Exactly why he has an argument for MVP as well. And then down the stretch, it ended up being Kawhi, but Harden still had a really strong overall game. 39 points, 12 assists, 3 rebounds, and then he ended up actually, so he had 0 turnovers in the first quarter, ended up with 7.
Yeah, it was a 39-23 first quarter for Houston, which they were just bombing threes on San Antonio, and then San Antonio was able to come back with some help for their bench. With Harden out of the game, they held Houston to a mere 15 points in the second quarter, and trailed only by 7 at halftime, and then were just inexorably able to come back. They put up 65 points in the second half on that Rockets defense. They also actually did a pretty decent job of forcing a few more mid-rangers than Houston normally takes, and really a big key as well down the end. Houston actually led this game 104-98 after a Harden three with 3:50 remaining, and a key foul on Trevor Ariza, kind of a phantom call on Kawhi Leonard shooting a three. He of course made all three of them, and then Kawhi made 2 more free throws. Then he made a 9-footer to put them up, a personal 7-0 run, and it was really all free throws. LaMarcus got fouled as well, and the Spurs scored 9 straight points. Houston's crunch time offense did not look good. There were 2 times in the last few minutes as they scored. I mean, they had that 104, and really they only scored 4 points in the last 4 minutes of the game. A three by Gordon and then one James Harden free throw. It was just kind of ugly offense most of the time. They had a couple of open threes that they missed, but they had 2 possessions where Harden just jacked a three without ever passing it. One of them was a fadeaway three in the corner. He ran a pick and roll, got the switch, and then went into the corner and shot a fadeaway three without ever passing it. And one was just a pull up before they even tried anything with Kawhi Leonard Harden on him that was pretty contested. Greg Popovich, for his part, really went with Danny Green guarding James Harden more. Harden lit him up for most of the game, as you mentioned, just an incredibly efficient performance throughout most of the game for Harden. But what do you think of this? I mean, we've seen more and more Danny Green guarding some of these really good wings on the other team.
I think Green is better on ball than off ball, so Harden is an unusual one. That's why I like Green typically better on ones, but Harden, you know, that's his role. And you have to trust it, though, that Kawhi he's a great help defender as well, but I think he's a better matchup for Harden. And I keep thinking about just the nature of, if this was a playoff series, it'd be so fascinating. Also in this game, Lou Williams,
I really hope
one...
these two teams play,
yeah,
by the way.
So
this
do I.
would be such a contrast in styles. I really, really enjoyed this fourth quarter.
It was a lot of fun. And there are also reasons why the Rockets did lose the game and struggled offensively late. Like, Lou Williams was 1-for-10 from the field. Eric Gordon was 4-for-10. I could see them doing a little bit more in terms of bench offense, even though their bench overall, you know, did relatively well just in terms of a, you know, an overall team perspective. But I just want to know what this would be like in a series. I talked about the idea of at various moments about how it'd be fun to see Tony Allen guard James Harden for a series, but the Spurs doing it would be a whole different thing. And we've never seen that series. Like, there are a lot of different rehashes that are possible in this playoffs, but that's a genuinely new one. And it's also even more interesting because the Rockets are a totally different team than they've been before anyway.
You mentioned Lou Williams did not have a good game. He's been lighting it up aside from that. D'Antoni went back to Patrick Beverley to close the game. I thought that that was the right move just in general. I think that Beverley gives them more what they need, especially if the ball is going to be in Harden's hands. Do you agree with that rather than playing Lou Williams?
I actually like Eric Gordon against the Spurs. I think that his size can be a defensive advantage, and he's just hard to deal with in terms of somebody like Tony Parker.
Yeah, that's interesting because Ryan Anderson actually suffered from lower back stiffness and missed the second half of this game, and so they went with Ariza at the four down the stretch. A lot of that guarding Aldridge. Ariza committed a couple of fouls on Aldridge in the fourth quarter trying to guard him or front him, or they would have Ariza trying to guard Gasol. The Spurs actually then ended up closing with David Lee. Deadman did not have a good game. He only ended up playing 9 minutes. I think he's just a little bit too rim protection focused, and Lee actually moves his feet reasonably well. He's other than just trying to draw a terrible charge on Harden that was ended up being a key play that he got bailed out by Leonard's three late, where he should have just gone for a jump in verticality. I thought Lee, is we've talked about, has improved his defense so much with the Spurs. But yeah, this is always going to be a contrast between the two traditional bigs. We did see a little bit, I think, in the second quarter, Kawhi at the four. I think it was actually pretty effective, but still, Greg Popovich believes in his two bigs. That's what he's really going to be going with here. And it's going to be tough to some extent, though, because Lee, Gasol, Deadman, Aldridge, like, those guys could struggle a little bit to defend in space against this Rockets team. That's why I think, although the Spurs are better, I kind of like this matchup for Houston. I also think that Harden has traditionally actually done pretty well against Kawhi Leonard, one of the few guys who really does do decently against him.
Let's root for it. I mean, it'd be a blast. And actually, in some ways, the Spurs winning makes that a little bit less likely just because the Rockets are so locked into the three at this point.
Yeah, they are. So we got to get to Clippers, Boston, and Warriors, Hawks. But first, if you want to go see any of those teams, SeatGeek is the way to do it. SeatGeek has been the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On podcast way back in July of 2015. Someone who worked there listened to the show, had no idea how many listeners we had, but just emailed me and said, hey, do you want to be one of the first podcasts that we're going to be on? And I was like, oh, we can make money off of this. That sounds like a good idea. Let's start doing that. Almost 2 years later now, here we are with this as our primary business. But the reason that SeatGeek has been so popular with our audience, there's two of them. One is it aggregates ticket sites together. You used to have to go to a bunch of different sites. You worry that you're missing out on a deal if you didn't check as many sites as possible. How many sites are you going to keep checking before you decide that you've seen as many good deals as you're going to? You don't have to worry about that anymore now. SeatGeek aggregates them together all in one place, so you can be sure that you're getting the best deal. The second part of that also saves you some time in that they rank every ticket based on value. So if you have a certain section that you want to sit in, you can just see whichever one is ranked best in value. Trust that you're getting the best deal based on the location and the price. And now, oh yeah, this process just took you a minute instead of 20 minutes like it used to back in the day. Of course, it wouldn't be a Dunked On ad if you didn't get a discount and also have a code for tracking purposes. Let them know that you came from us. That code, of course, is CapSpace, which we talk about all the time on the program. You get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. They will send you that $20 after you have made it. So that's the free SeatGeek app. Download it. Click on settings. Click on add a promo code. Put in CapSpace, all one word, and SeatGeek will send you that $20 after you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. Let's get to Boston and the Clippers now. Al Horford was out in this game, but Boston was very effective early on. Isaiah Thomas, the Clippers did not really have an answer for him. And at one point, Boston led 66-53. At that point, the Clippers went on a 41-14 run.
Included in that was Jamal Crawford going absolutely insane at the end of the third quarter when he was just bombing everything. And he actually missed the shot at the end of the third, which you felt like at that point everything was going in. And Boston without Al Horford is a fundamentally different team. I don't think there's any reason to say otherwise. But I was concerned by how Brad Stevens reacted to that, because the lineup that was out there, the part of the game that stuck out to me was the end of that third quarter, and the lineup that Stevens had was just hopeless. Like, there wasn't a theory of like how that group was going to generate successful possessions on offense or defense.
Yeah, that lineup was Terry Rozier, Marcus Smart, James Young, Jaylen Braun, and Jordan Mickey. Mickey had to come in because Olynyk, this is one of the big problems. I think he can be a very effective player, but if he plays more than 20 minutes, he gets in foul trouble. And he did again here. He had five fouls in this one, despite being plus five. And Mickey, in his 3 minutes, was negative 14. That didn't go too well. And that was with Crawford hitting the three straight threes. Blake Griffin went, a couple of those were pretty tough shots. Blake Griffin went straight to the rack once in transition. But I thought the bigger problem was just that they couldn't score. And then they were getting beaten in transition. Another issue for the Seas, they were 6 out of 24 on threes in the first half on some very, very open looks. I mean, 24 three-point attempts, you're very happy with getting up that number, especially if they're open, and just couldn't capitalize. And then the Clippers really locked down defensively in the second half, held them to only 11 attempts. They're 4 out of 11. That's much better. So I thought it was really the Clippers defense on that second unit, amazingly, and going against a pretty weak Boston second unit without Horford, it was all with Isaiah out of the game. Isaiah actually was plus one in a game that they ended up losing by 14, and he played 35 minutes too. He had 32 points on only 19 shot attempts, 8 of 9 from the line. So it was just clear that the second unit didn't have it. And this was one of those cascade effects that you always talk about, where the starter is out, all right, you have an okay backup, but then who's the backup to the backup?
It all runs together. And another element of this game that I found interesting was the Clippers actually really struggled playing with the lead late, and they did a great job of establishing it. They had a nice run at the beginning of the fourth quarter to really prop up the lead and make it look like they weren't going to need Chris Paul to come back in. I think Blake had already gotten a little bit of a spot minute and actually looked pretty good in that. And I wrote this on Twitter, but the basic, for at least from my perspective, and of course you can say if you disagree, when a team is playing with a pretty comfortable lead, even if the other team has their starters in, it grinds down to three basic tenets. One is control the ball. Two is just get a shot up in some form. Don't turn the ball over, you know, anything like that. Stay composed and then get back on defense. If you do those three things and you work the shot clock down, you'll be fine. And the Clippers rushed a few. They got caught in some traps. And this is an exceedingly veteran team. This is an old team. And it was jarring to see them get into that. And it's not like the Celtics had a murderer's row out there, though players like Jaylen Brown did do some nice things during that stretch.
This was also marred by plenty of hacka on DeAndre Jordan.
Yep.
And he deserved it because he went 3 out of 16 from the foul line. Overall, the Clips were 29 of 47, and Boston actually got to the line plenty as well. So that was definitely not the greatest aesthetic game when the fouling was going on. When there wasn't fouling, I thought it was good. Blake Griffin continues to be great. They had no one to guard him. 26 points, got to the foul line for 9 out of 10, 8 of 15 from the field. Chris Paul, just another brilliant, efficient game from him. Ho-hum, he's back to just being a dominant player. 23 points in 30 minutes on only 14 shots. Interestingly, JJ Redick only played 18 minutes. He kind of struggled defensively in this one, had four fouls, and then they actually were pretty effective with Rivers and Crawford on the floor. Rivers was plus 20, Crawford was plus 15. He had 19 points on 13 shots, 4 or 5 on threes. So we didn't see much of Redick, but those guys actually came through. Hopefully, though, that won't mean that Doc's going to play them more in most games, because Redick obviously is the better option most of the time.
Right. What did you think of Jaylen? He got getting the start tonight just because of their whole kind of garbled rotations.
Yeah, they started with Crowder and Brown, and then Amir Johnson, who I thought actually could have played more in this game, although he ended up with 5 fouls again. I mean, he and Olynyk are both just massive foul magnets, so it's hard to play them that much. I thought Jaylen looked good. I still would like to see him get a few more chances to do something, actually initiating the offense with the ball in his hands. But just his hustle, I thought he was pretty decent on the glass. He's been pretty decent on the glass this year compared to where he was in college. His closeouts really are excellent defensively. He was getting a lot of praise from the announcers. It was the players only announcers. He's getting a lot of praise for them for his feel. Kevin McHale, a former coach, was saying that, so I'm inclined to believe him at least. One thing that I thought was interesting, though, is, you know, I noted that great game that Blake had. The announcers were like killing him, like, oh, he's not going fast enough, like he's not going strong enough. It's just funny to me how everybody and their brother, whether it's just like some guy standing on the side at the park, some dude who's playing with a big guy in a pickup game, or just announcers watching a big guy, they always want to give like a big guy advice, right? And it all goes back to this philosophy, which has always annoyed me, of like small guys being like, oh man, if I just had this guy's height, like I would be like the most dominant player ever, right? Like they don't get the idea that if you're a big guy, like you actually kind of are slower and you lose coordination. Like you don't get to just transplant the body of a 6 foot guy into like a big man. And so they just assume, oh yeah, like you, if you have like physical talent and you're a big guy, the only reason you could possibly be not succeeding is like you're not going hard enough, you know? And so they're just, there's not as much respect as you might like for the dark arts of being a big guy sometimes. Everybody and their brother has always got advice from. My favorite, this is one of my favorite ones, right, is well, don't bring the ball down, like if you get a rebound before you go back up with it. It's really hard to not bring the ball down. Like try how you there at home, how about you stand with your arms above your head, try to jump up in the air, land, and then jump again while you still have your arms above your head. Pretty hard to do, isn't it? Like you're getting about 2 inches off the ground, and like it takes a lot of work to be able to just like keep your arms extended above your head and then jump again and put it back with any kind of accuracy while you're getting jostled around by a bunch of other guys. Like sometimes you have to bring it down because you're off balance. And yeah, you might get stripped every once in a while, but you're not gonna be able to jump unless you bring the ball down and then like gather and go back up again, unless you're superhuman. So that's just like one of the examples, a little bit of a pet peeve of mine as, you know, a big guy who used to have people yell at me at the park by like some schlub who had no idea what he was talking about all the time.
As a smaller guy, we're all very sorry. Well, actually, most of them aren't, but I am.
Well, at least you've never yelled at me like that I was like doing something wrong.
When oh, hell played. No. So
there's that.
Granted, I'm also not a good enough player to be able to do that to anybody. So that's part of this.
All right, let's talk about Golden State and Atlanta here, unless you had anything else on this one.
No, not really. I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on this. To me, the story was it changed at a little bit after halftime because Dennis Schroeder was dynamic, phenomenal in the first half. He's actually, as a couple Warriors fans noted, he's looked good against the Warriors a lot in the past. It's just one of those matchups that Steph Curry has trouble with because they don't really have anybody for waterbug point guards. But he was killing it from the field. He was 4 of 6 from 3 in the first half. And then about 3 minutes into the second half, into the third quarter, the Warriors went on this run. Curry got an uncontested or a lightly contested 3, and the wheels fell off the train.
Well, yeah, Schroeder had 19 in the first quarter as they put up 42 points. It was quite a yarn in that first quarter, 42-35. And then
he outscored the Warriors starters in the first half. Schroeder alone outscored the Warriors starters.
Yeah, the Warriors bench maligned by us in recent days actually has been outstanding the last 3 times that they've been in now, including the second half of that Knicks game on Sunday. But the play in question really was interesting. You know, Schroeder was having a great game, of course, with 23 points in 24 minutes. The Warriors just inbounded the ball and Steph just threw it right to Steph and he just shot a wide open 3. And the reason that he was open was because Schroeder and Howard had miscommunicated on a pass on the other end and they were just like continuing to yell at each other. Schroeder was distracted. All of a sudden, Dwight points out there and there's his man, Steph Curry, shooting a 3. Bud immediately sent Malcolm Delaney to the table. And Schroeder never came back in, to the point where he had to give Delaney a rest by just going with Kent Bazemore as the point guard. He was just so ready to discipline Schroeder. And now this is not exactly the first recent incident for Schroeder. You remember he was suspended for a game because he didn't get back from the All-Star break on time, claimed that there was some kind of an issue where he took his new passport instead of his old one and he had the visa in his old one. And then he didn't start the game after that because he was late for the team bus. So, and you hear rumblings that a lot of people really dislike playing with Schroeder. As we mentioned, Atlanta made that commitment to him. It was a little cheaper than we thought it was initially. I still don't know about that because I'm not convinced that he's the guy for them. And I think they would have been maybe better off going into restricted free agency and just kind of seeing what happens with him, because I don't think there was that much of a downside of someone just like going crazy on Schroeder as far as a contract. But just in general, things are rough for the Hawks. They've lost three straight now, all at home. One of them was to Cleveland. They gave up a $135 to Cleveland. Defense wasn't good in this one either. And with all this turmoil, it casts another light on their decision to keep this team together, despite the fact that so much of it is going into free agency.
Despite the fact that so much of it is going into free agency, they still have a lot of money committed to Bazemore, Howard, and Schroeder now. So the reason I supported waiting on Schroeder also was just to maintain that flexibility in case Paul Millsap goes somewhere else. You can go in a very different direction. You still have match rights, so if it's a reasonable offer, you can still deal with it. And they went in a very different direction with that. And there are a couple teams like this. I guess it's just the nature of the Eastern Conference. Like, we talk a lot about how the Bulls are problematic, how they can be frustrating. The Bulls are probably going to make the playoffs. The Hawks have had these issues. They're probably going to make the playoffs. I think they're going to end up as the 5 seed. It's just the way that this is in the East, because other teams haven't really risen up enough to push them down. Though maybe the Pacers can do that and give us the 4-5 series that at least the two of us want.
Yeah, this is another loss for a Hawks team that was 7 games over 500, I think, at the All-Star break, but had a negative point differential. That is continuing now. They're projected by 538 at 43-39, but to have a negative 0.9 point differential. Pacers and Bulls also projected at that. And the Heat, 2 wins now over Cleveland. I'm sad that we didn't watch that game, because I would love to see how well they played against Cleveland. Cleveland sat all their guys down in Miami over the weekend. And when you just look at the projections, the fact that the Heat won these 2 games against Cleveland, they would have been massive underdogs in. Amazing. They are projected at 41-41, better point differential than any team other than the top four right now. And they're looking pretty dangerous. The Heat could get the 5 seed. Who knows? It's pretty incredible where they're at. They're 30-34 now. Just remarkable how well they've been playing at this point.
Dion Waiters, 29 points and was big in the fourth quarter of that game. I didn't watch that much of it, but it's immensely satisfying to see him do well. And he's been a big clutch guy this year against good teams. I mean, big in this one. I think he was big in both of the Cleveland games, and then of course had the game winner against the Warriors, and has had a couple other big moments as well.
Let's talk a little bit more about the game itself here.
Sure.
That second quarter, what was it that enabled the Warriors to really get back into the game? I think they trailed it at one point by double digits.
So they got scoring from a lot of different players. One of the big moments was Klay Thompson picked up his second and third fouls in the first couple minutes. So he's playing now after that disastrous moment with the Knicks. He's pretty much playing all the time at the beginning of the second and fourth. And so you're sitting there going, oh, well, who are they going to throw in now? McCaw started. They don't really have a ton of other options. Ian Clark came in and scored 7 points, did a nice job, was more assertive, fine defensively, nothing too prominent. The Hawks don't exactly challenge your backup guards defensively. So I thought that was important. Andre Iguodala scored 24 points in the game, was the most points he has scored since the 2015 finals game 6, the deciding game of that series. And as Slater pointed out, it actually was in a tweet. I thought it was in his piece, but it was on a tweet. This was the first time since December of 2015 that Iguodala has played more than 31 minutes in consecutive regular season games, and this was a road back-to-back.
Yeah, 35 minutes for Andre. That 24 points came on only 8 field goal attempts, 8 of 11 from the foul line, 4 out of 6 on threes, also added 3 offensive rebounds and 4 assists and 3 steals. Really just a tour de force performance from him. And really, the Warriors got 13 offensive rebounds. It seemed like just about all of them were by smaller guys who were just out hustling the Hawks to the ball. A lot of it. And Steph Curry got it going a little bit. Still was only 8 out of 20, but had 24 points, 6 out of 15 on threes, but did have 9 assists, was setting his teammates up. I am a little worried for this Warriors team, at least while KD is out, and still we don't know how long that's going to be, that Matt Barnes just can't make an open shot. I think that could be an impediment for them, because he's going to have plenty of open shots to take.
Yeah. I mean, when I watch them over these last few games, they've seemed eminently beatable. Like, that is okay. You know, they've played a couple road games against
good teams. This was a good game by them. I will say
sure.
I
mean, absolutely.
With the foul trouble. Draymond Green was really good, too, in that third quarter as well.
His
getting some
was,
contested
was,
defensive rebounds, and you know, he was excellent there. But
right, and they got some good bench performances. McCaw was actually willing to take shots in this game. He was in the starting five because I think the dynamic they're going to go with is that they, during the next month or so, they'll play Barnes if the other team has a big three, and they'll play McCaw otherwise. That worked out reasonably well here. But something else to watch, doing the work I do for The Athletic, I've been tracking is Sean Livingston has struggled to find an equilibrium all year. On the days that he's really trying defensively, he can bring enough, even if he's not, you know, being an active part of the offense. But on the nights when his jump shot isn't falling and the defense isn't really there, he's become more of a drag than he ever was in the earlier years of this contract.
Can you guess what Sean Livingston's shooting from the field this year?
42.
Close. 54.3%.
Oh.
And now I agree, he has not been that useful in a lot of ways because we know he doesn't space the floor. He has not had as high of a usage as he's previously had. He's only averaging 5 points a game, not quite as many minutes as he used to either. And with Kevin Durant or Klay Thompson really on the floor whenever he is, or Draymond Green, he doesn't have the ball in his hand as much. There, his post-ups used to be one of the two or three things that they really would do all the time on the second unit, and now that hasn't happened as much. But I mean, that's pretty damn good from a guard nonetheless, 54%, and a lot of mid-rangers in there too. But yeah, lately he's only had one good game in his last five. Let's talk a little bit more from the Hawks perspective. We talked about Schroeder's game. Dwight Howard, despite the fact that he just never touches the ball still, definitely gets on the glass. He had 19 rebounds in 29 minutes. I mean, his per minute rebounding this year has been outstanding, but he also committed some dumb fouls. He got into that argument with Schroeder and ended up -8 in those 29 minutes and did not close the game, got taken out after he committed his fifth foul. Kent Bazemore also scored well, took a lot of shots against his former team, but generally was not a part of the solution defensively. And Mike Muscala, who was great earlier in the year, totally out of the rotation for Muscala now. Ersan Ilyasova has been playing a lot, and he actually had 15 points, most of that taking place in the first quarter. So Ilyasova is not, or the first half, Ilyasova has not really been that great for them. He hasn't made a huge difference. And Tim Hardaway also, again, scored pretty well. But, you know, these guys are not like amazing defensive players.
Dwight, it's just so weird to see it in this because he's still doing a nice job defensively overall. This wasn't necessarily his best game there, but he's become such a small part of their offense today. He did have a lot of like listed touches when you look at the sport view tracking, but 4 shots from the field, 6 shots from the line, despite having 5 offensive rebounds. So he had more offensive rebounds than shot attempts, and he had 5 turnovers.
Yeah, the turnovers never good. I'm sure a couple of those were offensive fouls as well.
Yeah, I think at least two of them were.
And how are you feeling now? It's been 4 games, I think, without KD. They had the Warriors had that miserable loss in Chicago where they couldn't score in the fourth quarter. Played well after the initial shock of KD going down against the Wizards. You know, a decent win against the Knicks. This was, I thought, was a decent win against a decent team. A lot of road games are at 3-2 on this road trip. How are you feeling about their chances of maintaining the number one seed and maybe even how to compete in the first couple of rounds of the playoffs with basically this team if KD doesn't come back as they hope he will before the start of the playoffs?
They've certainly taken like a tier or two down just in terms of where they are at this moment. That doesn't mean they will be there permanently, but they're not getting those bursts in the same way. They had one in the third quarter today where they just absolutely went off. I think it was 16-4 run against largely starters versus starters, but those have been less frequent, though, those dominant stretches. But it is encouraging that for them that the bench has done well. So if that gets to be a little bit more consistent, they were a disaster in that first stint against the Knicks, but as you said, the last three have been pretty good. So I would say they have a decent shot of holding on to it, but the big challenge is that they need at least a split, I would say, to feel a lot better about themselves, at least a split of the two games against the Spurs. And both of those games, I believe, are in San Antonio and on the tail end of a back-to-back. Nice little middle finger from the schedulers just to do that, to have it in that structure. But that's the way the schedule works. It's every team has unfair parts of their schedule.
Yeah, well, and that's a good plug for Twitter NBA show Second Screen on Saturday at 8:30 Eastern, when we will be doing that Warriors-Spurs game. It should be a really good one. I think the big difference between this year and last year's team, even with KD out now, I mean, they survived quite well without Harrison Barnes, you remember. I think the depth is actually as good or better than it was last year. I think that Steph, in particular, just, you know, has not been as good as last year, maybe not even as good now as the MVP season. He had a great January and now has fallen off since then, had that miserable, I think, 4 out of 31 stretch on threes over a three-game period. So maybe he'll start to find his rhythm again, but the evidence is certainly mounting that basically since the moment I said that he was back and he was back to being the best player in the league, he just has really disappointed since then. So I clearly have to back off of that at this point a month later. And I think the other thing too is just, is their clutch. They don't have that clutch dominance that they had last year. And so that's going to be a huge issue, because if then they went with Green at center down the end of the game, you know, they were just basically like guaranteed to win. Like they're outscoring the opposition by a point per minute, essentially. And they're pretty much just a mediocre clutch team at this point this year. So those are the two issues that I'll really be tracking: Steph and their clutch performance. And we're going to see them in the clutch a lot more without KD, without them just blowing teams out now.
We will. And we also won't know, a key part of this is just how open is Kerr going to be to going to those Draymond at center lineups. It was part of what cost them in game 7 last year. Because of that precedent, we won't know that until the playoffs. We'll just have to kind of sit here and speculate idly.
Yeah, and they actually probably don't have anyone as good as Brandon Rush or as Harrison Barnes to be the four in those lineups, of course, with KD out of the game. All right, we done here?
Yeah, I think I promoted this a little bit yesterday, but you can listen to the Tears podcast I did with Tim Bontemps, which is now out. I released it late last night.
All right, and follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Don't forget about that Twitter NBA show on Saturday, which we already plugged. Just go onto the Twitter mobile app, find me on Twitter, NateDuncanNBA, hit that little bell, and you can get a notification whenever Danny and I go to live video. So we'll look forward to talking to you then, but we still have three more shows this week, including hopefully a 15 and 60. Now that I'm home, we can get the research going on that. And we will talk to you all next time. Till then.